Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Today, Northwest News correspondent Liz Jones takes us to Seattle to meet one of the first Syrian families to arrive in the Northwest. The Alhamdan family is among the millions displaced due to war in Syria. Governors Kate Brown and Jay Inslee have committed to welcome immigrants. We'll hear about that in a few minutes. But first, we think about Paris for a moment and visit winemakers and food connoisseurs in Washington who have strong roots in France.
Gilles Nicole has felt really far away from his family.
I'm not on Facebook, but I called them.
He waited because it was really late in France when he heard the news.
So I have my uncle over there and some nephews, and all my in-laws are over there as well, and we're all fine, you know.
Nicole came to Eastern Washington in 1994 as a young winemaker. His wife is also a French-born winemaker in the Walla Walla area. Over the weekend, he says they got a lot of support from their local friends.
A lot of friends sent email and text and called me and whatnot. We're allies, you know, we are really friends, you know, between Europe and USA, all that. We are really close.
Nicole says it's hard to be far away, but he loves being a winemaker in Washington State. So he'll be following the news in France from afar. I'm Anna King in Richland.
American Airlines Flight 1239 touched down at SeaTac Airport last week, and a family of Syrian refugees walked down the jetway into a new life. They're one of the first families to arrive in the Seattle area since the United States agreed to take in more Syrian refugees. A civil war in that country has displaced more than 4 million people. Liz Jones was there for this airport arrival.
The welcome crew includes about 6 people with bundles of pink roses.
Give the mom and the older daughter the flowers.
And welcome signs in Arabic.
This one says, "Thanks God for your safety."
That's Yukana Yusuf. He's with a refugee resettlement agency called World Relief Seattle. Next to him, Carrie Conklin waits with a sparkly gift bag.
Just a little care package of candies and, you know, a little candle. Also some cardamom.
Conklin is part of a church group that's volunteered to help this refugee family get settled.
They're here.
Another World Relief staffer leads the family out of the arrival area. The father's in a tan, 3-piece suit. It falls a bit long over his hands and shoes. His wife follows close behind, along with their 6 children. The oldest is 19 and shy, the youngest 5 and full of spunk.
Merhaba. You guys want to give the flowers?
The Alhamdan family speaks 0 English, so Yusuf translates. He introduces the welcome party. Everyone just smiles and nods. Then the father, Bassam, tells us something already clear from their faces. The family is exhausted.
So he's so tired from being traveling for 2 days, from Jordan to Cairo, Egypt, then New York, then Chicago, then here. All what they want to get now is some food and a bed to get some rest.
American Airlines Flight 2310 from Dallas.
We walk toward the baggage claim, and World Relief staffer Scott Ellis describes the days ahead for this family.
They're actually going to go to a host home with a local family and stay with them and just rest and recharge while we kind of go over the plan for the first couple months that they're here. And eventually they'll meet with an employment specialist to talk about what work looks like, and then the kids will get into schools and doctor's appointments if those are necessary and things like that.
In a couple weeks, the agency will move the family into their own apartment in Federal Way. The Alhamdan family are among the millions who fled a violent civil war in Syria. And since then, only about 25 other Syrian refugees have been resettled in Washington state. But the numbers are expected to gradually nudge upwards. In September, President Obama announced the U.S. aims to take in at least 10,000 Syrian refugees next year, although many relief agencies called for much, much more. The mom and kids sit on a bench to wait for their luggage, and we go over names again.
Okay, nice to meet you.
There's laughter, then a sobering moment, and everyone's shouting. 5-year-old Ahmad has sprinted to the door, nearly to the street. He returns with a wide grin, all is forgiven, and everyone's attention turns to another church member who's arrived with her small dog. The younger kids can't get enough. 10 large bags come off the carousel. This is all the family has carried as they fled Syria to a refugee camp in Jordan. Again, Yusuf translates for Bassam, the father.
So yeah, he was in the camp in Jordan for 7 months. Then he decided to move out to find a better place.
He says the camp lacked clean water and he ended up with kidney problems.
Mainly, you know, like refugee camps, mostly it's not the very perfect environment.
We walk toward the parking garage, and this time, one of the caseworkers takes young Ahmad by the hand. Bassam stops and gestures around. He's wondering where he can smoke.
Okay. You
want to see? They tell him it's a half-hour car ride. Can he wait? Bassam nods. His family left Syria nearly 3 years ago. They've learned to be patient, waiting for so many things, and especially for today. I'm Liz Jones, reporting.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown said Oregon will welcome Syrian people. Brown was silent on the topic this week as governors throughout the United States expressed their views on the topic after the terrorist attacks in Paris. Brown announced on Twitter that the refugees seek safe haven and Oregon will continue to open the doors of opportunity to them. Brown then followed with another tweet saying, "The words on the Statue of Liberty apply in Oregon just as they do in every other state." The U.S. has accepted roughly 2,500 Syrians since the Civil War started. About half are children. Only 2% are single men of combat age. At least 19 other U.S. governors have called to block Syrian refugees. Governor Jay Inslee said his state would continue to accept refugees, saying he felt the screening process was thorough.
It is much, much more robust than the screening process we have for people just coming here on tourist visas. So people, you know, some of these terrorists were from Belgium, and they could get on a plane on a tourist visa and come to New York, you know, or Seattle for that matter, with much less screening than we have that if somebody sought refugee status.
In a statement, Governor Inslee said he stands firmly with President Obama and his call to not equate the issue of refugees with the issue of terrorism. But many people are making that connection. One of the Paris suicide bombers has been identified as a Syrian who entered Europe in the wave of refugees. Mark Cadle heads up the Spokane Office of World Relief. It's a national refugee resettlement agency. He's been inundated with calls about Syrian refugees.
Like as far away as Kalispell, Montana, far south as Pullman, and including northern Idaho as well.
He says most people who call want to offer help, but about 10% are people with concerns about security, religious extremists, or a tidal wave of new arrivals. And Cadle explains to them,
what they're seeing on the news media that's happening in Europe is totally, totally different than our modern refugee program here in the United States.
One major difference is the U.S. puts all potential refugees through a battery of security checks.
By the Department of State, Homeland Security, Department of Defense, FBI, and the National Counterterrorism Center. They have to qualify, have to be passed by all five of these federal agencies before they're even allowed to be even interviewed for possible resettlement in the U.S.
That process often takes more than 2 years, and it's for people in refugee camps, not for those who've migrated to Europe. Millions have fled a brutal civil war in Syria and the same kind of violence now linked to the Paris attacks. President Obama has called for the U.S. to accept at least 10,000 Syrian refugees next year. So far, only a few dozen have settled in the Northwest. I'm Liz Jones.
In spite of the stand of other governors, or maybe because of it, Governor Inslee continued his remarks by saying, "It's a matter of state and national honor to reach out to those displaced by war."
But don't break faith with 200 years of American history. Don't break faith with the beacon of hope that is embodied in the Statue of Liberty. Don't give up with the fact that we should join with the citizens of Germany and France and England against ISIS and in favor of their victims of ISIS by taking reasonable measures to protect these families who are so devastated.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Bridge. In other Northwest news this week, we learned that media consolidation is not confined to commercial broadcasting. Nonprofits are subject to the forces of economics as well. This week, Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma announced it will sell public radio station KPLU to another Seattle broadcasting station, KUOW. It will sell all broadcasting rights and facilities. KPLU airs NPR as well as jazz. KUOW will become the primary news station. KPL's frequency will become all jazz. KUOW's Amy Radel reports with assistance from Oregon Public Broadcasting.
KUOW and KPLU have had a long relationship. Both air NPR programs along with local news, but KPLU has another identity as the region's jazz station. The two stations help fund a network of regional journalists, and they hold joint events for their donors. But Thursday, KUOW General Manager Karen Mathis announced the stations have reached an agreement for her station to buy KPLU's assets for $8 million. She spoke at a meeting of the University of Washington's Board of Regents, which approved the deal as KUOW's license holder. Mathis said KUOW will become the sole provider of NPR and Northwest News, while KPLU's frequency will become home to a new all-jazz service.
We hope to entice millennials and even their younger cohorts into the door with compelling music, events, and music education programs, as well as with the news and information that tells stories that resonates with them.
Mathis says KUOW's studios in the University District will host the jazz service as well, and the station will hire several people to run it. She says KUOW could broaden its reach using parts of KPLU's existing radio network. The rest of that network will be used for the jazz service.
KPLU 88.5 has four full-power FMs and then its translator, so 11 frequencies total. So once the deal, the arrangement closes with the FCC, we'll be reapportioning what's on each of those 11 frequencies. So the news will get greater reach.
Donna Gibbs is the spokeswoman for Pacific Lutheran University. She says the context for the sale was that radio audiences have been slowly diminishing each year. She said it makes sense to pursue a shared vision rather than splitting the NPR audience between the two stations. She and Mathis both said the duplication of NPR programs on the two stations was a major reason for the change. Gibbs said she hopes by eliminating that double cost, local donors will give money to support more local news instead. At KPLU Studios in Seattle's Belltown neighborhood, some employees said they're disappointed that Pacific Lutheran University would sell the station. General Manager Joey Cohn says he's thrilled about the full-time jazz service, which is something Seattle has never had. But feelings are mixed.
People are sad, obviously. I mean, we've had people that have worked here for decades and very proud of the work that they do. But I think given the options of what could occur, I think that this is the best option for the future of public radio in this market.
It's unclear now what will happen to KPLU's employees, 36 full-time and 15 part-time. Mathis says there are a few upcoming hires in the KUOW newsroom regardless of the deal, but that all employees will have to apply through the UW's open process.
There's, you know, a certain amount of gallows humor, but people are freaked out.
KPLU reporter Gabriel Spitzer says right up to this announcement, he'd been making plans for the new local program he hosts called Sound Effect. So this announcement came as a shock.
Well, none of us are guaranteed jobs. It's hard to imagine a future where all of these reporters remain employed. So in that sense, it feels like a loss for the region to lose professional journalists.
He says there's a lot of uncertainty since their jobs will continue as usual until FCC approval. That could take a year if someone opposes the deal. I'm Amy Radel reporting.
In its announcement, KUOW said it will develop several new positions for the music service. A spokesperson for Pacific Lutheran University said they don't expect any immediate layoffs. FCC approval will take several months. Perhaps this is a good time to thank our members. Your support keeps independent local programming on the air. Coast Community Radio thanks you.
Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
The White House has announced that a late civil rights activist from Hood River, Oregon, and Indian Treaty Rights Advocate from Washington State will be among this year's recipients of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the country's top civilian award. Minoru Usui was the first Japanese-American graduate of the University of Oregon School of Law. In 1942, he openly defied the wartime curfew against Japanese Americans, an act that got him sent to a Portland jail for 9 months of solitary confinement. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld the conviction in 1943, and Yasui spent the rest of his life appealing that conviction. A federal court eventually overturned it in 1986, the year he died at age 70. Congressman Greg Walden supported the nomination in a letter to President Obama. He said Yasui's act of civil disobedience was compelled by faith in the rule of law and the U.S. Constitution. Also being recognized by the president from Washington State is Billy Frank Jr., an Indian Treaty Rights and Environmental Stewardship Advocate whose advocatism paid the way for the Bolt decision, which reaffirmed tribal co-management of salmon resources in the state. Frank, who died in 2014, led effective fish-ins, akin to sit-ins of the civil rights movement, during the tribal fish wars of the 1960s and 70s. The awards will be presented next week at the White House. In our final feature this morning, we meet another daughter of Hanford, Michelle Gerber, historian and mother of three. It was late in the Cold War, 1987. In a government reading room in Richland, Washington, Michelle was studying newly released documents about the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. Then a strange man approached her. Correspondent Anna King tells the rest of the story.
That day, the tall, thin stranger asked Michelle Gerber to coffee.
And I asked him, you know, who he was and why he wanted to talk to me.
She thought he was working for the feds.
And, you know, he just used some of his training, I suppose, but it was kind of oblique and it was, well, you know, we're just curious.
She was on to the biggest story of her life, and he was interrupting.
And I said, absolutely not. I'm an American citizen. I have a right to be here, and I'm busy.
Gerber was unlocking the story slowly with government documents, cryptic stuff.
There would be a lot of mysteries. Keywords would jump out, but you didn't know what they were, code words or just strange terminology. And so I would go to the footnotes, and pretty soon I started filing Freedom of Information Act requests to request what was in the footnotes, because that was going to lead you down a trail.
Gerber was a PhD historian and mother of three young children when she moved to Richland. She started reading articles in the newspaper about Hanford waste releases into the air and about people who got sick. Gerber wondered if there was a bigger story. Gerber says U.S. Department of Energy officials began asking her who she was and what she was doing.
Well, at the time, in the mid to late 1980s, the DOE still was a very secret organization, and they had their traditions, and they probably felt, who is this outsider? And, you know, why do we need to share information?
They needed to share it because she had requested it under federal law, and one day it showed up at her doorstep, 18 volumes of typed government documents from World War II. She pulled an all-nighter.
I could not stop reading. I remember finally just lying on the carpet and watching the sun come up and still reading.
Those volumes and other documents proved the government released radioactive waste from Hanford from 1944 through the Cold War to the air, water, and land. She detailed the infamous Green Run. That's when the government released radioactive iodine and chemicals into the breeze. It was tracked as far away as Spokane. There were contaminated soldiers, salmon, and backyard veggies, experimental sheep. Pasco farmers had been sprinkling their fields with sullied Columbia River water. And most people didn't know a thing. But when she shared this news at public talks in the Tri-Cities, sometimes she'd get heckled, booed. Some people would cry. They were hearing this information for the first time. Their Shangri-La was spoiled.
Their immediate reaction was, you don't know, you weren't here. But the documents don't lie. And so I began bringing documents with me, actual documents.
Gerber's book, On the Home Front, has sold thousands of copies. Now she's lived in Richland for nearly 30 years. No longer an outsider, but Gerber works hard to keep her outsider eyes.
Hanford is different. It's not your typical American place. And it's really important to keep that perspective. Don't let it become so ordinary that we don't continue to think critically about it.
She says with Hanford, you just can't get too comfortable. I'm Anna King in Richland.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of the program, you can hear it on a podcast at our website at coastradio.org. We enjoy hearing from you. Email questions or comments to News One. That's N-E-W-S and the numeral one at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thanks for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge.